We want freedom!
In Baltimore!
In Baltimore!
And when do we want it?
Now!
No justice!
No peace!
I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. As protesters prepare for more demonstrations in the streets of Baltimore, we round up the week's top news. The death of 25-year-old Freddie Gray from injuries sustained while he was in police custody. The Baltimore Sun reports today that as a child, Gray had damaging levels of lead in his blood from the house his family rented in West Baltimore. The Sun also reported that if Gray suffered his fatal injuries while handcuffed and in a police van, he would not have been the first man so injured. Mary Rose Madden of WYPR's news staff joins me, along with Baltimore City Councilman Nick Mosby. And we have open phones for listener comments on the Freddie Gray story. Midday Friday starts after the news from NPR. It's time for Midday Friday, and we review the top news story of the week, the death of Freddie Gray from injuries he received April 12th while in police custody, and how Baltimore City officials and the community are reacting. There have been demonstrations in the street all week, with more expected. Today, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake meets with clergy, activists, and community leaders to discuss how to ensure that demonstrations remain peaceful this weekend and to decide how to handle out-of-town protesters. Good afternoon, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us for Midday Friday. Freddie Gray, 25 years old, died last Sunday, 1 week after he was arrested by police near the Gilmore Homes in West Baltimore. He died from injuries to his spinal column. New details are emerging on the timeline surrounding Freddie Gray's arrest, his injury, and his subsequent transport to shock trauma and his medical treatment. The city fire department released a medical response timeline yesterday that showed an ambulance arrived at the Western Police District at 9:33 a.m. on April 12th and left the station at 9:54 a.m. to transport Freddie Gray to shock trauma. The Baltimore Sun reports today that as a child, Gray had damaging levels of lead in his blood from the house his family rented in West Baltimore. The Sun also reported that if Freddie Gray suffered his fatal injuries while handcuffed and in a police van, he would not have been the first man so injured. Others have been injured during so-called rough rides in police wagons over the years, and they or their families have successfully won damages from the city. Also earlier this week, the Justice Department launched a probe into Freddie Gray's death. And in the meantime, an internal memo from Police Commissioner Anthony Batts urged police officers, quote, not to lose focus, end quote, during this time of investigation and protest. I'm joined here in the first segment of our show by Mary Rose Madden of the WYPR news staff, who's been on this story during the week. She's been reporting on the protests and the reaction of Baltimore officials to Freddie Gray's death. Mary Rose, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And also with us is City Councilman Nick Mosby. Nick Mosby represents the 7th District, which includes part of Sandtown, Winchester, and a wide swath of the west side of Baltimore. He's a member of the council's Public Safety Committee as well. His wife, Marilyn Mosby, is the city's state's attorney now. Nice to have you on the show, Nick Mosby.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
It seems like last week, the first week of this story, when the video first got out after April 12th, we were paying attention. There were some news stories about it. The video certainly was in circulation. We talked about it here on Midday briefly with David Zurowick last week. But then everything changed on Sunday. Everyone's attention, this got everyone's attention on Sunday, it seemed, Nick.
Completely. I can remember receiving the call that Sunday morning to find out that he had passed away. And you're exactly right. Folks really started to pay attention. Unfortunately, we've seen in our city all throughout, Baltimore, it's not a West Baltimore thing. It's not even really a Baltimore thing. Urban America, the disproportionate amount of policing that we have and the level of policing that we have and the type of policing that we have. So the first questions that always came out, not just from his family or his friends, but also from the community, was one, why was he chased? Two, why was he detained and arrested? And ultimately, what he was charged with. And I think that was a lot of the basic information that didn't come out right away that folks really, really want it. And, you know, then when he passed away, it just completely exacerbated the frustration and the anger around the situation. I got the call to my office that Monday after the event took place. Someone from the community reached out to my office to let us know what was going on. And, you know, that's when I started to call the police and try to figure out, you know, what took place and what happened.
Mary Rose Madden, in addition to covering the protests this week, in the week before, Thursday night, town hall that was held at Coppin State by the Justice Department, which is conducting an investigation into police misconduct in Baltimore City. Did this come up during that? I'm just curious if this came up during that town hall.
Oh, it definitely did. There were hundreds at the town hall meeting, and the lines to talk at the mic were 20 people deep at each mic the entire time.
Did they mention Freddie Gray?
Oh, they sure did. Yeah, I mean, you know, they got up. I mean, Tyrone West's family got up and talked about, you know, there's someone in the hospital right now who's suffering from the stuff that we're talking about, the police brutality that we're talking about. And at the time, you know, the U.S. Department of Justice, they were just there to, quote unquote, just to listen. And, you know, Baltimoreans gave them an earful.
The mayor of Baltimore, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, and the police commissioner, Anthony Batts, had a press conference on Monday. First, here's the mayor, and then we'll hear from Anthony Batts. I'll tell you what, just before we go into these clips, Anthony Batts talking about the medical attention Freddie Gray received or didn't receive during his transport from Western District Police Station to Shock Trauma. But first, here's the mayor at the press conference.
Commissioner Batts and the Baltimore Police Department are moving very swiftly to complete a thorough and comprehensive investigation as soon as possible. We're committed to transparency, and we will release additional details as we complete our investigation. But our primary focus remains on providing a prompt and comprehensive understanding of the incident so that we can respond accordingly. I understand the frustration of the community, and I take very seriously our obligation on transparency. However, we also have to balance that with our obligation to ensure a proper and thorough investigation is undertaken. Therefore, we have to move forward in a responsible way to determine all of the facts of this incident so that we can provide the community with the answers, the real answers that they deserve. I want citizens to know exactly how it happened. And if necessary, I will ensure that we will hold the right people accountable.
There were several times that we should have clicked to getting medical requests. He asked for the inhaler as he was going into. At one or two of the stops, it was noticed that he was having a little trouble breathing, where we should have probably asked for paramedics or had him look at that time.
That's Commissioner Batts responding to a question about the medical attention Freddie Gray didn't receive, or his request for medical attention in response to a question from a reporter about that. Mary Rose.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting because that's, you know, huge questions. How many, you know, what happened during the stops? What was said during the stops? And he was requesting medical attention, and yet the police put leg irons on him.
Right. There were stops made once. Well, first of all, for folks who need to be up to date on this, Freddie Gray was taken to the Western District first. And then, as I said before, he was taken by the fire department ambulance to Shock Trauma. And there were stops made before he got to the Western District. One stop or two stops.
Some point, they stopped to pick up another, or the driver got a call to pick up another suspect in a totally different area, in a different case, you know, different problem, and picked up someone else. I guess one could ask, at that time, perhaps the driver should have said, I've got an issue on my hands. I can't stop. I should not stop.
Nick Mosley, what questions do you have about this particular aspect of it, the transportation? You see the Sun story today saying that the city in the past has had to pay out considerable amount of money in damages to people who have been injured. In one case, a fatality resulting from these rough rides in the police wagons, police vans.
It's troubling, to say the least. I mean, again, you know, the simple information. What was he arrested for? You know, what was he charged with? And then once the police took him into custody, you know, the word custody means something. You know, they're supposed to ensure that they protect his his person. They're supposed to be sure that he's okay. And, you know, I know that they've come out and said that he asked for medical help. You know, why wasn't it rendered? Why wasn't it provided? Hearing the specifics and the details around all that, you know, is really important to the community and important to folks. So,
well, what do you think about the way this is being handled by the administration and the commissioner? Is there more information we could have had by now or could have had even before Freddie Gray died? As we pointed out, I mean, all the interest in this heightened once Freddie Gray died. It makes you wonder what would have happened to this story had he survived in some way his injuries.
Yeah, I think the cornerstone of the frustration and anger, especially from his friends, his family's community, originated with why was he being chased? Why was he followed? Why was he detained? Why was he arrested? And, you know, when he's laying in that hospital bed after all this is done, they look at him as a seemingly healthy 25-year-old within a matter of less than an hour has a severe injury to a spine. They're looking at this like, why can't these basic answers be provided? So, you know, we've seen this issue happen over and over again throughout our history and throughout the country where there's small amounts of information that you could literally tell folks, yet sometimes, I guess, as government, we try to hoard it. But really, that's the type of information that they should put out there right away because there should have been a justification for the police to arrest and charge him.
Let's go to this soundbite from Michael Davey, attorney for the Fraternal Order of Police, who talks about, addresses that, you know, what happened there, why he was chased, why Freddie Gray was chased by officers. So this is Michael Davey, the president of the union, the attorney for the union, Fraternal Order of Police.
The officers observed an individual in the Gilmore Homes, which is considered a high crime area, and it's also been designated by the Baltimore Police Department as a crime hotspot. Due to the fact that it is a high crime area, an individual who was Mr. Gray and another individual were observed, and unprovoked, they both fled the police. There is a Supreme Court case that states that if you are in a high crime area and you flee from the police, unprovoked, the police have the legal ability to pursue you. And that's what they did. They pursued Mr. Gray. They detained him for an investigative stop. Had he not had a knife or an illegal weapon on him, he would have been released after the proper paperwork was done. However, in this case, he was in possession of a spring-loaded knife, which is in violation of Maryland law, at which time he was arrested. Everyone keeps going back and forth that there was no probable cause. In this type of an incident, you do not need probable cause to arrest. You just need a reasonable suspicion to make the stop, and that's what they had in this case.
That's Michael Davey again, the union attorney for the Fraternal Order of Police. You're listening to Midday here. You're welcome to call us. We have open phone lines for discussion of the Freddie Gray case. 410-662-8780 is our number. The Midday email address for comments or questions that way, midday@wypr.org. Let's talk a little bit about the protesters. Mm-hmm. Mary Rose Madden was out there in the street. What did you hear from the protesters mm-hmm. during this week? We heard a lot of anger expressed.
Oh, yeah. Everybody out there, very angry, very anxious. You know, nobody really trusts this internal investigation that the Baltimore City Police are doing into their own seeming, you know, their own problems right mm-hmm. now. And then to see that the internal investigation will get passed to the state's attorney, and then they just don't trust this process at all.
Does it help having the Justice Department in on this then? The Justice Department said it'll launch a probe. So,
yeah, some
people, going back to the Ferguson case, I just want to add this, have said, you know, one of the problems here is police and local prosecutors, they work very closely, but when it gets to so that when it gets to cases involving police officers, it ought to be moved to an independent or an independent prosecutor. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
At the end of the day, I think that in this case, it's not just the police doing the investigation, but also my wife is doing her own independent investigation. And you're right. I think having the Justice Department come and be involved in it provides an extra layer of confidence to the community to have the DOJ looking into it. So I'm confident with the investigations being handled independently that they'll get to the bottom of the facts.
So a couple other things that people are saying this week, you know, no one really agrees with the fact that the six officers who were involved are suspended with pay. That's a big problem out there. They don't under it's you know, a lot of people are saying, you know, it looks like a vacation to them.
And it's interesting that this is all sprung up now because, you know, in Annapolis there were several bills on law enforcement bill of rights and the rights of police officers specifically around situations like this. So well, the one thing I think it's definitely energized is that discussion for the next session down in Annapolis.
Nick Mosby, I wonder, before we take our break here, if you could address this for me. So people are protesting, as they should, these serious questions they have about the way the police conducted themselves with Freddie Gray. Understand it. He's dead.
Yeah.
He probably didn't need to be dead. He probably didn't need to have this encounter with police, maybe. We'll find out. Anyway, is that what the protest is about? That the police shouldn't even approach Freddie Gray? That there's been too much of that over the years? We went through the whole zero tolerance period here in Baltimore City.
Yeah.
Has there been just too much of that? Because people want safe neighborhoods, do they not?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What I'll say is you put me on the worst corner, the worst neighborhood from a statistics, crime statistics perspective, and it's more productive individuals who care about their community than they are the ones that are causing, you know, the violent crimes and all the issues that are driving this perception for Baltimore City of being such a violent place. With that said, you know, when we see the protesters and we hear that anger, we see that frustration, that is decades old systemical type of things that are placed upon those individuals. I mean, when you talk about zero tolerance, when you talk about stop and frisk, when you talk about things that are being done in these communities for folks who look a certain way, they have problems and issues. And now Freddie Gray is just the latest example to allow them to exercise and invoke their energy behind this particular issue. I think that the one thing that, you know, I continually tell folks is, you know, let's do peaceful marches, let's do peaceful rallies, continue to vocalize that frustration, but let's develop a way of tying it into some productive change around policy and procedure in the city of Baltimore. You know, we know this is not a Baltimore issue. This is an urban America issue, specifically the disproportionate amount of impact that the criminal justice system has on our urban America. So I think that the combination of all those variables, Dan, is the real frustration, is the real reason, is the real energy behind a march like Freddie Gray and then Ferguson and other places throughout the United States.
You know, the protesters told me, we're not going to sweep this under the rug. Next Friday, when the results come out, it's not over for us. You know, we're not going to forget this.
And it should not be. We can't allow this to just go away in vain. We can't allow it to just sweep this under the rug. This can't be just another name to this senseless loss of life.
Nick Mosby, city councilman from the 7th District of Baltimore on the West Side, and Mary Rose Madden of the WYPR news staff is with us. Just finding out today that funeral arrangements have been made for Freddie Gray. His funeral will be held on Monday at New Shiloh Baptist Church with the Reverend Dr. Harold Carter, Jr., is the pastor. We'll take a break here. We'll listen to more voices of the protesters as we go into the break, and then we hope to hear your voice. So give us a ring, 410-662-8780.
I just want it to be an end to all this misery and all this pain. Children should be allowed to go outside and play and walk to the corner stores and go to school without all this humiliation and hatred. They hate us so much. As African Americans, we're tired. We're tired of it.
That's messed up. She ain't even out here trying to. What is she doing? Why is she not out here? That's all we want to know. Where's Al Mad that's supposed to be out here? Where's she at? She's supposed to be here every day. Where's she at? She ain't here.
That's the voice of Sheila Conway, who is taking part in the demonstrations that Mary Rose Madden of the WYPR news staff has covered. Mary Rose, so last night I was at City Hall where the march started, and then you were over at Western District. There was, I guess, another demonstration there.
Yeah. So, you know, the voice that you just heard, Sheila Conway, she was one of the very passionate voices on Wednesday night. Last night, Thursday night, same place, Western District, the concrete barricade was removed. You know, it really aggravated the protesters on Wednesday night. So last night they removed it and they put probably about a 3-foot metal fence around the district office. And they had, it seemed to me, more police officers standing on the grass, on the sidewalk, just watching the protesters. So there wasn't like as much chanting and quite as much just absolute fury. People were sort of milling about, talking about what's going on, trying to figure out what to do next. And then at one point, these really young boys, like 8, 9, 10-year-old boys, probably about 20, 25 kids like this, were sort of taunting the police officers, making fun of them, and then taking it to the next level, you know, saying some really mean things to them, trying to, I think maybe trying to get a reaction. And they were just kids. And then I would say, like, the neighborhood grandma maybe came up, and she gave them a what for, you know. She told them, you know,
to stop.
Yeah, she said these guys aren't involved in this. These are innocent, you know, people just doing their job. So that was really interesting to me. Now, fast forward a couple hours, it's cold, it's dark, the protest is sort of winding down, and you have a couple, I would say 5, 6 African-American police officers, you know, you could tell they're sort of higher-ups. They approach the fence. They come to the fence, and now there's like clusters of groups, and they're talking about what's going on. They're not shouting at each other. I mean, mostly what I gathered is the police officers were listening to groups of moms. I mean, this group of moms, they were distraught. They were really upset about what's going on. Then you'd have maybe some teenagers, older teenagers, 19, 20, 21. Then they're talking to the police officer about, you know, as an African-American man, you should be on our side of the fence talking about these issues and profiling and what's going on in our community. It was very interesting.
I would say so. Thank you for that description of that, Mary Rose. And these demonstrations have been mostly peaceful.
I've been out every night. I was out there last night as well. And you're right, they've been mostly peaceful. I mean, the one thing I continue to tell folks is, you know, once the national media leaves, you know, the out-of-town agitators will leave as well. Because, you know, a lot of the folks that you can see aren't really here to be productive because they don't have, like, a natural care about West Baltimore, these communities. You know, they're really trying to rile the crowd up. So, you know, it's critically important that we get to our children and we just continue this message of peaceful protest.
Nick Mosby, City Councilman, Mary Rose Madden of the WYPR News staff. Now let's hear from our listeners. Chris in Baltimore, we'll go right to you first. Hello, welcome.
Good afternoon, Dan, and to your guests. My question is, as many comments as I would like to make, my question to the councilman in particular is, did you know that this designation existed for your district as a hot spot? And just what are your feelings of what it seems the ramifications are? Because from what I heard, the comment of the FOP representatives, it sounds like that designation allows the violation of constitutional rights. And I for one, have a problem with that.
Yeah, so specifically the reference there, Michael Davey, the union attorney, saying that the Gilmore Homes is a hot spot.
Yeah.
And under a Supreme Court ruling, if an individual in the hot spot area, you know, runs away from police, police have a legal right to pursue.
Yeah. Of course, I know that around that area in Central West Baltimore is a area of high crime. It's a high crime area. I did not know that, you know, it was probable cause or articulable suspicion for someone to be running and the police, by the Supreme Court rights, be able to chase them. You know, I'm not a lawyer. I did not know that. You know, we do have serious issues in this part of West Baltimore. You know, over the past two summers, I've hosted 47 rallies called Enough is Enough rallies, going to these high crime areas and these high crime corners, specifically in and around Gilmore Homes, with the community and with the police. The unfortunate part about this Freddie Gray situation is, I think that the chasm has grown even wider, you know, so all the work that we've been trying to do of, you know, bringing the community together with the police and really going after violent crime in these areas, I'm concerned that maybe some of that is hurt. You know, at the end of the day, this does nothing but further that chasm between the community and the police and exacerbate the distrust. So we're going to have to develop ways of trying to build it back.
But at the same time, there is an opportunity. I mean, last night, the police seized on a big opportunity, I mean, to come to the fence. Yeah, to come to the fence. I mean,
yeah.
And you heard police officers saying to the protesters, thank you for being cordial.
Yeah.
Thank you for being respectful. And, I mean, they were kind of starting to understand each other.
And Mary, if I can jump in, that's what it is. It's about relationships. Everything is about relationships. And just like we have the small amount of violent repeat offenders who give our city this bad perception on crime, we have a small amount of folks in the police department that aren't really interested in having those types of relationships. But unfortunately, through their actions and through their involvement and their interaction in the community, it presents this huge wand of negativity towards the police department.
But if there's no accountability, then
exactly.
Then we're just, yeah.
Walt makes this point in an email to us from Baltimore County. He says the Sun posted a video showing a confrontation between police and citizens following an arrest of an individual for jaywalking. It is doubtful that police would have taken such action against a white male in Charles Village or any other predominant white area of the city. It shows a lack of sensitivity of police to that situation. The police looked like occupiers.
Dan, I spoke out about that. That was throwing gasoline on a fire.
This was a man who was taking part in a demonstration, right?
Well, he was two blocks away.
Oh, he was two blocks
away. He was walking, leaving a store, walking across the street, and one of the news cameras happened to be there and captured all on tape.
So it was near
two blocks away.
Yep. Yeah. Back to the phone lines. Jonathan in Canton on the southeast side, thank you for calling. Jonathan, go right ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I thought that the rough ride could be a red herring in this case, because I think that, you know, the officer chasing him after eye contact, maybe there's a beef between him and the cop or something. Because the other thing is, if it did happen during a rough ride, maybe it broke his back further. I guess it was like 80% severed, I think I read. But the fact that they were dragging him into the paddy wagon by two cops on either side of him, another one had him by the belt, it looked like he'd already broken his back by that point. So I just find the whole thing kind of strange.
Thank you very much for that comment. A lot of us have problems with this idea that the injury, the mayor said something like, what happened in the van. And if you look at the video, it's sort of hard to separate what happened before he was in the van to whatever happened in the van. In other words, he was in a great deal of distress before he was put in the van.
Yeah, he went from running from the police to being dragged into the van.
Yeah. Also, that description of the injury, that 80% severed injury, I believe we've only heard that from Billy Murphy, the attorney for the Gray family. I haven't heard that from an official source at the shock trauma or the hospital or the medical examiner yet. Alan in Long Green, out in the county. Thank you for calling, Alan.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. I think this is going to end up being the most nuanced case of all of the cases we've seen recently, and I think it's going to raise three issues. One is we talk about profiling, and profiling is definitely a problem. Freddie Gray may well have been known to some of the police who were out there because he had a record of about a dozen arrests over the last 7 or 8 years, primarily for controlled dangerous substances. And I've heard on the news allegations that he was an active heroin user. Worth noting there, that leads into the next issue, the level of care that's given to people who are arrested while they're in custody. There have been a number of studies over the last 20 years showing that heroin users suffer serious bone mass loss as a result of using heroin. So how do you know the condition of the person when you're making that arrest? So I think the level of care is going to come up. And finally, the level of force, because, again, if somebody is frail because of a chronic drug use, the amount of force needed to subdue that person without hurting them may vary. And so I think it's going to be a very nuanced case, and it's going to raise some real questions about how to do effective policing.
Thank you very much. I wanted to go back to the time lapse here, the time that's being taken for the investigation that we're being asked to wait for. Do you think that's been prudent on the mayor's part and the commissioner's part?
I think, we're going on 2 weeks. I think, you know, for the complexities of this case, the sensitive nature of this case, I think that you want to make sure you get to the bottom, and you want to make sure you get real details. Unfortunately, I think there were some missteps of not coming out with basic information and maybe changing some information. But it's critically important that you provide the community with real solid facts, from the medical examiner to all the other things that have to be compiled. So, you know, as a lay citizen, you know, having an investigation go on for 2 weeks, I don't see that as
well.
Troublesome.
Interest certainly accelerated last Sunday when Freddie Gray died.
Totally.
Prior to that, you have to wonder what was being done.
Yeah,
right?
And I think that's the something that we will never know. But you know, unfortunately, because he passed.
Lynette in Canton, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My comment is this: if this were a traffic accident, Freddie Gray would not have been moved. His leg was clearly immobile. He was screaming in pain. And the first rule is you don't move them, you stabilize them. But because he's black and because it's a police thing, all those rules are ignored. And if nothing else, that caused his death. You see him in the video with a totally immobile leg being dragged behind him. He shouldn't have been picked up. He shouldn't have been moved. He should have had medical care. And it's maybe not racism, but it's certainly acting out of very deep prejudice.
Plus, once they got him into the van, and I point well taken, Lynette. Once they got him into the van, he wasn't buckled in, according to police procedure policy. So it's another aspect of this.
Besides policy, common sense.
And common sense, right. Yeah. Bonnie in Baltimore, we'll take your call next. Thank you for calling Midday.
Hi, how are you guys?
Pretty good.
I wanted to, it's not directly about this case, but I am a citizen of Baltimore City. I live in the Hamilton area. My husband is a Baltimore City police sergeant for 20-plus years. My husband works in East Baltimore, Eastern District. My son is now a Baltimore City police officer in Northeast District, so I live in his district. I have owned a business in the late 80s, early 90s on the corner of North and St. Paul. Mid-80s, I worked on the corner of Monument and Patterson Park until 4 o'clock in the morning. I have worked
27th Street. Bonnie, I'm sorry. I just wanted you to get to your point because we're limited in our time here, but what did you want to say about all that?
That point is I am very familiar with the community of high of violence. So anyway, my number one prayer every day is that my son or my husband never have to use force to this point, or a gun, the gun that they were taught and how to use, because once they do, there's no support, none. My number one prayer should be that my husband and my son come home safe, but you know what? If they don't, that's when the community supports you. But when the police do their job the way they were taught, and something bad should happen, the community turns their back on them. It is a very ugly situation, and that is my number one prayer every day for my son and my husband. And so far, I've made it 20-some years with my husband, and hopefully I can make it 20-some years with my son. Absolutely a shame. Absolutely. Y'all don't know everything that happens on those streets, everything that's said and everything that's done. And my husband and my son are Korean, so they are a minority working in high-violence neighborhoods. That is my comment. Y'all have a great day.
Well, Bonnie, I had a question for you, if you have time for a question. When you say if an officer has to use a gun for some reason to shoot a suspect or even kill a suspect, you say that there's no support.
No. Nope.
What do you mean there's no support?
The community automatically turns their back on them, that the police did not do their job correctly. And then they're put on suspension, investigation, and they are taught to shoot to kill. They're not taught to shoot them in the leg to slow them down or whatever. And I know police officers directly that have been taken off the street, and there's no support.
Okay. I think it's policy to come off the street when an officer uses a sidearm, and there's an investigation.
And they're paid.
And they're paid. And I don't know that we haven't had officers prosecuted for anything like this before. We did have one officer who shot a fleeing suspect in a shopping center in Northeast Baltimore that I wrote about, and he was acquitted by a jury. And that was an unusual situation. I just wonder what she meant by no support.
I think one thing that Bonnie was talking about, too, that, you know, I think is true, right, is that it's a very stressful job.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, I mean, no one's going to say that's an easy job. one of the things that I talked to an expert a couple weeks ago, and I was putting together a story a couple weeks ago, and he said, you know, the police officer gets a call with very limited information, you know, just a couple of details, and then he's off. He doesn't know, or she, they don't know what they're stepping into. They, a lot of times, it's just a conflict resolution. It doesn't need a lot of you need to sort of nuance the problem and have a very delicate touch. And police officers are under a lot of stress. They often aren't trained with all of this, all of those tools. And I think a lot of that comes out in times like this when we're looking at these cases.
Yeah, but, you know, unfortunately, when you're dealing with human lives and you talk about the loss of a life, especially young lives, you know, at the end of the day, you have to understand and know that you can't allow that situation to continue. I mean, the fact that Bonnie talked about lack of support, when you look at throughout this country, the number of men that have been killed by police officers, and a limited amount of those have been even, you know, really investigated in or looked into or tried or even convicted of those crimes. I mean, more so than not, you know, you're not seeing the level of attention that the community wants to see.
Oh, definitely. But, you know, and I talked to a lot of people at the protests, and I would always ask them, you know, tell me about your experiences with the police. Negative. They tell me the negative story. Now tell me about a positive experience. And often they did. They had positive experiences, too.
Mary Rose Madden, thanks for being here today. Mary Rose Madden of the WYPR News Staff, and City Councilman Nick Mosby, thank you for your time today as well.
Thank you,
sure.
Dan.
Yeah.
More on this as we move along next week. We'll be addressing this story again on Monday's show. Right now, we'll take a break here on Midday Friday. Ahead of us is the Business Report, the weekly Business Report with Kevin Litton of the Baltimore Business Journal. Plus, a study shows that the leading cause of death for pregnant women in Baltimore is homicide. We'll hear how healthcare workers are trying to prevent these deaths. Please stay with us. Yes, on Monday's show, we'll continue to watch the Freddie Gray story. And plus, drivers learning to share the road with bicyclists in Maryland. That ought to be an interesting discussion. And backed by popular demand, Minion Fogarty, a.k.a. the Grammar Girl, she's been on our show before. We'll be talking with her on Monday as well. That's on the Monday show. Right now, it's time for the weekly business report from Kevin Litton of the Baltimore Business Journal. This is Kevin's last appearance on Midday, I'm sorry to say. But good for you, Kevin. You're taking a job in Baton Rouge. You're going to cover politics for the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. So good for you.
Thanks a lot.
Kevin Litton's had a great run at the Baltimore Business Journal, albeit too short, but he's covered a lot of news in that time. And so here, I guess I should ask you for the weekly wrap-up. Is there a couple of stories you wanted to talk about this week? And then maybe I just ask you a couple of questions about on the big development front in Baltimore that you've been covering for the last couple of years. Anyway, this week, what's in the BBJ this week? There's an interesting story on the cover, I know, about home sales. What angle did you take on that?
So I think what's really been interesting about the home sales market is this cultural shift that's happened since the recession. So I explored this for our cover story this week, and what I really found was that a lot of home buyers out there have really changed their attitudes about what they want out of houses. Before the recession, we all know that the McMansions had gotten really big. People wanted everything when they bought a house, and they were willing to pay top dollar for it. And now people are starting to say, you know what, I think maybe I want to spend a little bit more money on travel, or maybe I want to spend a little bit more money doing kind of a cool renovation in my house. I don't think it's worth it to spend all my money on a mortgage payment. So I found this really interesting couple. They bought in 2012, spent like $430,000 on a home in the great school district that Howard County has to offer, right? And that's what everybody wants. It's like the American dream to live in Howard County in the great school district. But they mm-hmm. realized all their money was going towards the mortgage payment. So they started looking again. They found a little house in Catonsville. It's maybe, you know, $1,000 less of their mortgage payment. It's a smaller house. Maybe it's not the great school district. But she said, the reason I got my husband to convinced him to move smaller is, hey, we can go spend more money on travel. We can go do fun things, spend it on life. So I think the new home buyer out there, very educated about what they want out of a house. They know everything there is to know about making a mortgage payment, interest rates, the whole thing, but they also count every square foot. If they see an in-law suite, they want to make sure that in-law suite's going to get used. If they see an extra dining room, they'll say, maybe I don't need the dining room. I'm only going to use it twice a year. I'd rather have a big, nice family room and a room there. So it's a big cultural shift that's happened. I mean, we're in a hot home sale market, but this is a very smart consumer.
Very interesting story, Kevin. So size doesn't matter as much as what's in the home, right?
That's right. And location.
And having disposable income for other things, too.
And people want to be close to amenities. Right. They don't want to drive everywhere.
Before you leave us here and leave Baltimore, so a couple of big questions. One has to do with the west side of Baltimore, right? We spent a lot of time talking about downtown and the waterfront, the southeast side, the south part of the city, around the harbor. But what about the west side? What do you see happening over there and when?
Well, the really interesting thing I think about the west side is that for 10 years, 12 years, maybe even 15 years, we've talked about the super block. That was going to be the catalyst, right? The Hippodrome was going to open and the west side was going to be fantastic. And it's never happened. I mean, the Hippodrome's there, but the super block certainly isn't.
Yeah,
but in
stalled.
But in the last 2 years, we've seen a series of small developers, very opportunistic developers, that have come in and started buying these smaller properties. Some of them have been near Lexington Market. Some of them are on Howard Street. And you're starting to see these really interesting ideas. There's a theater incubator that somebody wants to do. I talked to a developer who's just had really great success with immigrants that want to open restaurants. And so he builds, you know, takes old buildings, puts them in first floor retail, does some offices on the top, and he's had a lot of success in that. And so now that the city has tried to get rid of some of these city-owned properties, they're finding much more success with the small developers who are even willing to say, you know what, the super block will happen someday. I don't really care when, but I'd rather get my
rolling.
Project started now.
Interesting. We're going to be doing a midday, devoting some time on midday to the west side soon. And one other question I had for you, when he first rolled it out, developer Patrick Turner's ideas for Westport really looked exciting. That's become a mess. The recession wasn't too kind on those plans, and then he's been in court, bankruptcy, and all that stuff. Do you see anybody picking that up and moving it?
Certainly a tough project from the beginning. The city approved a $160 million TIF. That's in comparison to $107 million that they're going to do at Harbor Point. And this is all for infrastructure, because you can't build on this land without putting in the infrastructure for it. So it was a tough project to start with. He lost it in bankruptcy, and now somebody else has bought it. It's a big mystery. I went to the auction, and there were some representatives from Under Armour there. We still don't know if Kevin Plank was actually the purchaser. It's still a big mystery. But if you take a look at a map and you look at Port Covington's proximity to Westport, and there's an old railroad bridge that the city has already said they want to connect to make a bike trail to connect Westport and Port Covington, it starts to make sense over there. So we don't know, I want to stress, we don't know who the buyer is. It's still a mystery on the Westport property. But I do think that Westport does come into play with everything that's going on at Port Covington and Kevin Plank's purchases for the Under Armour campus there.
Kevin Litton, thank you again for another interesting report on our show. And thank you for all your reports coming in midday and contributing to this program and for your work at the BBJ. And good luck in New Orleans.
Thanks, Dan. This is always the most fun in my week.
Keep in touch, Kevin. Okay. Now we return to Dr. Diana Cheng, OBGYN physician and director of Women's Health for the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. You know, 7 months ago this week, the national news buzzed about the now-famous Ray Rice video, where footage from hotel security cameras showed the former Ravens running back hitting his then-fiancée, now-wife, Janae Rice. Next week, a symposium at the University of Maryland School of Social Work Auditorium in Baltimore will be held to discuss how to prevent domestic violence, how to help victims and survivors. That's why Dr. Diana Cheng is with us here. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So I just wanted to do a quick follow-up on this today, and maybe more later. You know, so much attention given to this subject during the Ray Rice period. Your research has shown that I was sort of astounded by this. 2011, this was a few years ago, we found that the most common cause of death for pregnant women in Maryland is homicide. Homicide, the leading cause of death, according to accounting for 17% of deaths, followed by cardiac disorders and accidents. But homicide, number one.
We were surprised as well. And this was a study that we did in Maryland, looking at every single woman who died during pregnancy or the year after. We thought the most common causes of death were going to be hemorrhage, hypertensive disorders.
Mm-hmm.
But it was homicide by far. And I think when we came out with that, a lot of people didn't believe us because they said, well, Baltimore's so crime-ridden. You know, it's all these ghetto crimes, drug crimes. So we did a further study and looked at it, and we found with the police that the perpetrators were intimate partners. It was domestic violence, and that's in every single jurisdiction community in the United States. It's not a Maryland thing at all. So I think we need to, as healthcare providers, instead of looking at these health problems during pregnancy, we need to also expand it to looking at social behaviors and to domestic violence as well.
In over half of those homicides, the perpetrator was an intimate partner.
Definitely. Two-thirds, actually, now, yeah.
What would you say overall has been the reaction in the, I'll call it the clinical community, when it comes to dealing with domestic violence since the Ray Rice episode?
Well, I think it's been a silver lining to that, because it has brought a lot of attention to that topic. But I think the clinical community has never been trained in domestic violence. I mean, they think it's a police issue, and legal issue, and not really a health issue. They don't think they can do anything about it, but we really can. And I think when we see women or men come through our clinics, we can really start the conversation about safe relationships, about how they're doing with their partners, and actually make referrals to local programs to get them have some interventions.
You mean at the doctor level, at the nurse practitioner level?
Yes.
People are uncomfortable with these conversations, though, aren't they?
They are, and I think that's why
when they suspect something, I mean,
they really are. But it's very simple, and we want to just do some training and education so they know they don't have to be an expert on domestic violence per se. They just have to be a resource for these women, so they say that we're comfortable talking to you. This is a conversation that we can have in a health visit, and we know how to make that referral and get you some attention or counseling or whatever you need.
I ask that question because there's this symposium that I mentioned that's coming up that maybe you can tell us about. It seems to be its target audience seems to be the clinical community, right?
It is, because I think that's a community that really needs that training and needs to know and be aware that this is a problem that's right under their noses and that they can do something about.
That healthcare workers need to know how to screen for this.
Yes, how to screen for it, and that it helps them be better clinicians as well, because we found that a lot of chronic diseases are caused or rooted in domestic violence. So if you see someone smoking and they can't stop, and you're just giving them patches and they still can't stop, and if you've never asked them about, do you have domestic violence in your background, maybe that stress is causing them to really need to smoke. So it's working at the problem integratively.
So you think you're all for bringing it up. If there's something you're all for encouraging people to have this conversation who currently now think maybe that's off limits, that you might offend a patient.
Yes.
Right?
We think it's as important part of the medical history as hypertension, because people are being injured by it. Chronic diseases are happening because of it. I mean, it's smoking, depression, heart disease, diabetes, migraine, headaches. All that is associated with domestic violence. So we really need to bring that into the regular health field.
You know, on the study you did on pregnant women and homicide, is there something about this period in life when a woman is pregnant that makes her particularly vulnerable to homicide?
That's an interesting question. And I think pregnancy and having a new baby is stressful even on the best of circumstances. So you can imagine with a problem going on with domestic violence in your home, how much more stressful that is. So,
The pregnancy itself could create the tension that leads to the violence?
Yeah, because there's a control issue. Do you want your partner to be pregnant? And if he doesn't, it's the lack of control, and then he acts out. So there is parts of that to it, definitely.
Dr. Diana Chang, will you be speaking about this at the symposium?
I will be.
Okay, so we posted some information about this on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. It's Wednesday, April 29th. Looks like an all-day affair at the School of Social Work, right?
Yeah, it's in the morning.
Oh, it's a morning, yeah. Morning symposium. Jacqueline Campbell, who's been on our show, a PhD, RN, will be the keynote speaker there. And Lee Goodmark, also from the University of Baltimore Law School, will be there as well. So more information about that on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. As we leave you, as we roll out this hour, because we're not leaving you, we have another hour coming up, the music of Robin Spielberg. Dr. Chang, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Robin Spielberg was on our show a couple of years ago. A pianist, composer. She lives right over the Maryland line in Pennsylvania. Actually, in the summertime, she lives near a cornfield, and she sits at her piano by the big window looking out in the cornfield and her flower garden and composing these pieces. She's performing tonight at Germano's in Little Italy. And she has a new album out, a new CD called Another Time, Another Place. She'll be at Germano's Piattini in Little Italy at 6 p.m. tonight. We thought we'd mention that to you, for those of you who have heard Robin on our show before. So we close out with Robin Spielberg on the piano and pizza from Joe Squared Pizza, located at 133 West North Avenue in the Station North neighborhood at the Inner Harbor at Power Plant, live and online at joesquared.com, providing pizza for our guests every Friday. Please stay tuned for the news and then the second hour of Midday.